Welcome to Rolling Stone Music Now. I'm Rolling Stone executive editor Nathan Brackett. Today we're going to talk about the biggest reunion of the year, Guns N' Roses. We're also going to answer reader mail about the late George Martin. But first, we're going to talk about what we're listening to in the office. I'm here with staff writer Brittany Spanos and contributing editor John Dolan. Hey, guys.
Hey.
Hey.
How you doing?
All right. Brittany, you suggested this new song from Andrew Bird, mm-hmm. which I'm enjoying quite a bit.
Yeah, he has a new album coming out on April 1st called Are You Serious? And a lot of the album sort of was inspired by marriage and having a kid and all of that. And there's this really cool semi-bitter love song that he has with Fiona Apple. And
which I love. It's like a little bit unusual for Andrew Bird, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like for people who don't know him, he's this super talented, like, multi-instrumentalist. Mm-hmm. I don't even know how many albums he's had at this point, but he's been doing it for a while.
He just released one last year that was more experimental, and this one's more straightforward, kind of folky.
Yeah, this seems like the most, like, straightforward song I've heard from him in a while.
Yeah, and it's called Left-Handed Kisses, and it's just this really cute, fun, kind of playful duet between him and Fiona.
I don't believe everything happens for a reason.
To us romantics out here, that amounts to high treason.
He recently performed at Ellen. He had this amazing violin solo during the breakdown that was just incredible to watch.
The dude can bring it on the violin. I love songs where, like, couples are talking to each other, and mm-hmm. this is clearly it. Like, he's, like, clearly a musician, and he's saying, you got me writing love songs, and she's like, they're just not enough. You know, you got to, like, do a little better.
Yeah.
It sounds like they're definitely, like, maybe not long for each other. What do you think of this one, John?
I like it a lot. It's funny. It's funny. You're right, because it's playful, but it's not pleasant in the way his music is being pleasant. It's, like, dark,
right.
And it's funny, and you want to see sort of the 6-part Netflix show about this couple's life and what led to this, and sort of, you know, it does. You're right. It reminds you of, like, George Jones and Tammy Wynette, and it's got that kind of country feel. It's nice to see her sort of sing. I mean, she's always direct and intense, but it's nice to see her, especially in the video, be so kind of mordant and aggressive, and it's a really entertaining sort of juxtaposition of what you'd expect from these people.
And she's just so awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I mean, like, she's gonna, like, bring so much to any song that she's on.
Yeah,
she's got a little bit of grit in her voice with this one. Like, it's a little angry, and especially during the live performance, she had, like, a little bit of, like, super sourness and, like, anger towards Andrew while she was singing it, which was really great.
Yeah, she really throws herself into the video as well. Her hair, and she's kind of the cold stare, and the, you know, and you wonder, like, I guess I didn't really know that they were collaborators, or they had collaborated in the past, or if they had any kind of background, but they really have a lot of emotional connection in this song, and it bodes well for this record, because you're right, his records tend to be nice, you know, and you wonder what this will be like.
Well, I think they're both part of that kind of LA-based scene, which includes, like, Blake Mills and just super talented musicians, and I'm happy that they did this. John, the song that you brought to the table is from a new group, Big Thief. I'm loving this.
Yes, they're a band from a place called Brooklyn, New York. one of those. And
up and coming.
Exactly. They're recording for Saddle Creek Records, which was best known for the place that kind of gave us Conor Oberst back about 10 years ago, a little before that.
And they have a little bit of that.
Definitely.
Yeah.
She sounds, I don't know, actually, I don't know where, the singer's name is Adrian Linker, and I don't know where she's from originally, but definitely a Midwestern kind of stuff.
They don't even have a Wikipedia page yet, which I love.
That's a new band. A band camp, not a Wikipedia. That's when you know you've got something really hot. But the record is coming out in late May. It's called Masterpiece. They had a song out called Masterpiece. Most of her songs tend to deal with the dark side of love and loss, and this was about sort of seeing the person you just broken up with, new person, and they remind you of you.
I guess I would say this is kind of the theme for today, right?
Yeah.
Like, dangerous love, like, dark love. Yeah. We try to find a theme.
Axl Rose's relationship to every member of Guns N' Roses would also fit into this. this new song is called Real Love, and it's this kind of starts off soft, it starts off quiet. It's basically a child's view of domestic abuse and kind of switches very poetically character and position and sort of perspective.
I'll always love you. Having your face hit, having your lips split by the one who loves you.
as the song builds, it goes into this kind of crazy, intense, sort of very Tonight's the Night, or, you know, on the beach style kind of guitar mania that recalls
which
kind
is
of
awesome.
The, mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, it's really, it really kind of, it, the sort of logic of the song is interesting because it is this kind of, it's quiet and reflectful, and it could be a folk song, but then the guitars kind of add a violence in the verses, and so it's a
you
really
kind of compared
song.
It to like a Crazy Horse with like a little bit of mumblecore.
Yeah,
or
it's
like
a little bit of a mumblecore Crazy Horse vibe. And this record that's going to come out is really fantastic. And she's definitely in this sort of like Sharon Van Etten, Waxahachie sort of mold of these kind of singer-songwriters who go in and on yeah. the sort of like intense side of romance and disaffection and stuff like that. It's
so
really
many
great.
Awesome like female front women in rock and indie rock right now.
It's mm-hmm. true. I mean, there's just, it's the combination of, you know, it's a great guitar band and a great sort of poetic singer-songwriter band kind of at the same time. And it's a really wonderful record.
All right. And then the final pick was something both of you guys suggested. It's from Anoni, formerly known as Anthony Haggerty of Anthony and the Johnsons,
yeah.
One of the great voices out there.
Yeah, one of my
the
favorite.
The last couple of decades.
Yeah. Definitely one of the most powerful vocalists. I mean, like, Anoni always brings a bunch of drama to her songs, just really subtly in the way that she delivers them. And Drone Bomb Me is going to be on Hopelessness, and it's this just super powerful song from the perspective of a child as well, a child whose family has been drone bombed. And so this is a girl that is begging to be drone bombed as well. It's just this incredibly powerful message, and the video starred Naomi Campbell delivering the song, and it's just Anoni's
really
voice
devastating.
Is incredible. Yeah.
Drone bomb me, blow me from the mountains and into the sea.
I remember when Aunt, the band that she used to front, Anthony and the Johnsons, when their first record came out, it was I Am a Bird in 2005, and just that voice, like, it was really like this kind of, you're hearing a cross between like Boy George and Yoko Ono or something. It was really unique and arresting, and there's places sometimes with her where the artiness can, you go pretty deep, but in this case, the power of this song, and also you think of songs about bombing and things like tend to be intense and violent to sort of match the sort of sound, but this fact that Death by Drone is this new, secret, automated, ever-present clandestine thing, and the music itself is subtle. You know, it's extremely powerful and works its way up on you in a way that you know, you're not expecting with this powerful voice. It's really an incredible song.
Mm-hmm.
And she's got a new album coming?
Yeah, Hopelessness comes out in May, and she's working with Hudson Mohawk and Onotrix Point Never on it.
These Which is two, an interesting mix, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Hudson
yeah.
Mohawk, former Kanye West
mm-hmm.
collaborator.
Yeah. The kind of electronic elements of it are really subtle and beautiful and really add to her voice and kind of meshes so organically together. And so it's very surprising and cool.
Yeah, it's the right fit for her, but you wouldn't really kind of on paper wonder if that would be the right fit,
yeah.
but it comes out great.
Mm-hmm.
Well, all right. Brittany Spanos, John Dolan, thanks for coming.
You bet.
Yeah.
And we're back. That was the opening chords of Welcome to the Jungle by Guns N' Roses, which is very likely what a lot of people are going to be hearing on April 8th when the full Guns N' Roses are reunited. Well, not quite the full.
Semi-full.
Semi-full. I'm here with Andy Green.
Hi there.
Associate editor, Rolling Stone, and Brian Hyatt.
Hello.
Hey, Brian.
Hello.
Senior writer, Rolling Stone, and we're going to talk about probably the biggest rock reunion of this year.
I am not convinced that it's definitely happening. Until they walk on stage together and I'm watching it on Periscope or whatever, I'm not going to believe that this is happening.
We are talking about Guns N' Roses. Listeners at home may well know the answer to this question right. by the time they listen to this podcast, whether
Possibly.
Guns N' Roses have actually gotten back together.
You really think they're not going to show up, Andy?
I think they probably will. They'll be sued, there'll be contracts, but, you know, it would be very tough to pull out at this point, but Axl does not give a shit and very well might just say, I can't do this. It's possible.
He follows his own way.
Yes, no, the shows will happen and they'll probably be pretty incredible, but there's so many questions. It's so confusing because they've said nothing.
Right. But the key of this is Axl and Slash and
Duff McKagan.
Are back together at Guns N' Roses. In terms of reunions that you thought would never happen, Andy, where does this stack up? With, like, the Smiths?
Well, this felt possible because Duff was back in the band and Izzy has guested with Guns N' Roses a few times. This seemed possible because there was so much money at stake and they kept getting closer to it.
So on the unlikelihood scale of like 10 being never happened, Smiths, Johnny Marr, and Morrissey hate each other, 1 being...
The Kinks.
Yes. Yeah, who have plans to reunite.
It feels like the Smiths hate each other in some kind of British way that we can't understand.
Right. It's unknowable to us. Well, there is something we will never.
Whereas this is, you know, it's just two American guys. Hate each other.
And, I think both Morrissey and Axl, they were both pretty crazy. But Axl is more interested in making lots of money than Morrissey is. I think that's a slight difference.
Crazy is so harsh, Andy.
It is. Words hurt. Can you give us a little bit of the history of the animosity?
They last played together in 1993 at the end of the Use Your Illusion tour. And they were one of the biggest rock bands in the world at that point. They were playing stadiums. They had huge hits. And then it just completely fell apart. And by the time the band was back in the late 90s, it was just Axl. And there was a new album eventually. There's been a ton of concerts with just
Chinese
Axl.
Chinese Democracy.
Yeah, that was 2008. So there's been a ton of shows with this new Guns N' Roses, but it kept
getting... Various iterations.
There were various guitarists. It's changed a lot.
Tommy Stinson.
Yeah, it was Tommy Stinson was there
He was like actually the only kind of constant.
Right.
Well, and Pittman, I think.
Well, fair. Right. Pittman, yes.
And Dizzy Reed.
But it's been Axl's show. It's been basically Axl Rose and his band of helpers.
It became like Nine Inch Nails, where it's just synonymous with one person.
Right.
But what happened was when they first came back, it was a big deal. They were playing big places. Slowly, it became less of a thing. They were doing the same exact show over and over and over
again.
Right,
like a lot of people might not realize that Guns N' Roses have been playing pretty steadily. What was the most recent gig with the Axl version?
In summer of 2014.
Right.
And by that point, they were doing Vegas residencies.
Right.
Yeah, when they played New York the first time, it was The Garden. When they came back the last few times, it was Roseland Ballroom and stuff. I mean, it was a shrinking affair because you can't keep doing the same show and expect to see big crowds each time.
He had been showing up on time, though, right? Axl Rose legendarily late.
He'd gotten better. On time is, I mean, the shows were still starting at midnight, right?
Well, I think increasingly they were going better. I think on the last couple of tours, he was mostly on time. In like 2010, whatever, I don't know the exact years, there were some shows that were past midnight.
Was he calling them at midnight? Were they supposed to start at midnight?
No, they were supposed to start at like 8, they're opening bands. And he's so awesome that he'd go on after midnight. So it would start when the curfew, it was already in place.
Yeah, I mean, I experienced this. I mean, you would wait in the Meadowlands in 2006. I mean, there was like an endless... array of opening acts, Papa Roach and stuff, like just torture.
Roach's next episode.
Jesus. And so you're sitting there, and then, you know, keep in mind, this is the Meadowlands, it's the middle of nowhere. You know, you have everyone has to, and everyone's adults,
there's only one way out.
Some
you gotta go to the parking lot.
So he goes on, you know, probably 12:05. I mean, the show ended at 2 in the morning on like a Tuesday. Right. You know, but honestly, that show was very good. I thought that show was good. I really enjoyed it. But for most people, the thing is like, where's Slash? Duff, right. I love Duff, and we all know that the full lineup would also include Izzy and either, you know, Matt Sorum and or Steven Adler. But for the average fan, they just want to see Axl and Slash.
Yeah,
together.
The key was Axl and Slash. And you were saying, Andy, that maybe Duff was kind of maybe the mediator. He was the sign.
Well, Axl had been saying for years that he wasn't mad at Duff. He even said maybe 8 years ago that he'd be willing to record with Duff again. And so Duff was kind of in both camps, and then maybe...
Well, Duff is a lovely guy, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he's like, you know, he's a journalist. I mean, we can all relate to him. He's written a column for a Seattle Alternative Weekly.
Everyone loves Duff.
He'll be wearing glasses if you meet him. He's just a really nice guy.
Yeah, I've had great times with Duff. Duff is a very nice guy.
Yeah. And then Duff's band got a slot as the opening act before Guns N' Roses a few years ago. And then Duff came on stage and did a few songs... And they started talking again, and just slowly he came back into the fold.
And then Stinson had to miss a tour because of the replacements.
Right.
So basically, my theory is that Paul Westerberg is actually responsible for all of this. Because I'm not even joking.
Okay.
So I think that Paul Westerberg, you know, the replacements united. And finally, Tommy Stinson, who had been trying, you know.
For people at home, Paul Westerberg, singer of the Replacements.
Singer of the Replacements, with Tommy Stinson's original band.
Right.
And it's very clever, by the way, of Axl to get a sort of punk-based bassist to replace Duff McKagan. because Duff was from a Seattle punk scene, so he was very carefully casting someone in exactly the same mold. Right. He's not a dummy. That's incredibly smart. But anyway, so Tommy had to miss a tour. And then Axe was like, who could I get to play bass? And then there's Duff. And then Duff was back. This, by the way, shows the diminished interest in the sort of new GNR that Duff was back in the band and no one really made
it was
a big
deal. Really they were playing right. South America and whatnot. Right, it was sort of off the grid.
So,
but,
and so what we think happened, right, Andy, is what did Duff probably say to, Axl?
If Duff was smart, he would wait a few weeks. He would get Axl comfortable, you know, to be his friend again and be like, you know what? Slash isn't that bad. You know what? Right. I think Slash is not the worst guy in the world, and maybe because Axl had really said awful stuff about him. He called him a cancer.
Where did things go wrong? Is there something you can point to with Axl and Slash? I mean, some of this we're not going to know, but
well, I think there's this whole missing years period. There's the wilderness years of Guns N' Roses from '93 when the tour ended till like '95 when Slash left, then '97 when Duff left, where they were really attempting to record a new album and it just fell completely apart. If you read Slash's book, like Axl begged him not to quit because he knew it would be a huge symbolic blow.
Right.
And then he left the group and started talking some smack about him, and Axl, he can't handle that. And then when GNR, they came back and played a Vegas gig, Slash joked about trying to actually go to the concert and was in Vegas at the time. It just sort of, at a key moment when the group had...
Yeah, he actually showed up and was barred
So it got really bad. And he was trolling Axl. When Axl had to prove his band was legit, all the attention is Slash was not let in the door. And I'm sure Axl went ballistic.
Right. That became the news.
Yeah, it became the thing. And so...
But I mean, just because I talked to those guys about what happened in the 90s, Axl wasn't sure what he wanted. They actually had a tough thing because, you know, Appetite was this classic album. Use Your Illusion had good songs on it, but it also felt like... Even they don't think it's as good as Appetite. And then they did the Spaghetti Incident, covers album. And then it was just sort of like, what do we do next? They knew it was like the night, you know, grunge had happened.
The Spaghetti Incident has something to recommend it, doesn't it?
It's a great human being cover by the New York Dolls. Right. I think that album is underappreciated. It's crazy. And there's that new guitarist on it. We're getting off track.
But they were trying to figure out what to do, and it was like sort of Axl was bringing in different guitarists to work to try to, like, quote unquote, work with Slash, and that was a disaster. He even brought in Zakk Wylde, the Ozzy's guy, and apparently that was like a nightmare. And so it was just, I think Slash was just like, I don't have a creative, I'm not allowed to. You know, it felt like Axl was trying to control the band at that point. So
I think every hard rock band has their Zakk Wylde, like, 6 months, right? But right, sorry.
Anyway, so but basically it's like Axl wanted control is the way the other people painted. He might say something entirely different, and I'd love to hear Axl's side. Maybe someday he'll share that with us.
Right.
So anyway, the other guys felt they had to leave, and Axl always said, listen, they all left voluntarily. You know, like Duff, which is technically true. Like,
well, not Stephen Adler, right?
Well, Stephen Adler was gone a long time ago. The exact moment when Sorum left is unclear to me. That's much more unclear.
Speaking of Sorum, it's very hard to get some reporting on Guns N' Roses these days. There's a kind of a cone of silence around Axl. Yeah. He leads what some people have described as a bit of a Howard Hughes-like existence in a compound somewhere in
California.
In Southern California, Los Angeles. But we managed to get a little bit of fresh reporting.
One of the most surreal moments of my life. I was getting lunch with Brian. We were talking about...
In Rockefeller Center.
Yeah, we were on Midtown. We were on 6th Avenue. We were talking about Guns N' Roses because I was reporting a Guns N' Roses...
Near the Rolling Stone offices.
I was reporting a story on them. I was hitting brick walls just everywhere. Name-check Matt Sorum. I said to Brian, do you think Matt Sorum is going to be there? We're talking about him. And we're walking back. As we're mid-discussion about GNR, I go, wait a minute. That's Matt Sorum.
on the streets of Midtown Manhattan.
He was the guest drummer on Seth Meyers that week. And
damn.
I stopped in my tracks, and Brian, he went like, hey, Matt Sorum. And he stopped, and he was like, hey, guys.
And we, you know, introduced ourselves, said who we were, and we're like, you know, what's going on? You know, so he gave us a little, he said his kind of money quote that we actually used in the magazine was like, you never know.
You asked him specifically.
Yeah, are you going to be part of this or what? Yeah, and he said, you never know. The answer, as best as we can tell, is no, he is not part
of it. That was the only quote from Matt Sorum,
or
from any member of the band.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Right.
He is.
I think you need to embellish the story a little bit, though, Andy. There needs to be a little bit more of a heads up. The kind of like, I don't know, you were scanning a corner of the street
detail. He walked right past us. He was wearing a hat. He seemed shocked to be recognized by anybody.
Right, that's true. He's not getting recognized by a lot. Only so many people are going to recognize him.
He was holding multiple coffee cups in his hand. He had a hat on and a big coat.
I totally think it's a great story.
And to be fair, I was able to, I said, you know, hey man, I did the last Velvet Revolver story in Rolling Stone. So it wasn't, then possibly remember. You know, it wasn't like, like we weren't complete randos.
He gave you that like celebrity nod,
But I mean, you know, he knew that story, so it wasn't like we were like completely,
he materialized out of thin air as we were talking about him. Right.
That was the most amazing.
All right, this is amazing. The first piece of reporting was within like maybe, you know, 500 feet or a quarter mile of the office. The other piece actually happened in the office.
In the office, yeah. I was on Twitter about 3 weeks ago. I got a tweet from an account that was called Izzy Stradlin 999. And it was like, hey, Andy, this is Izzy. I love to talk to you. And I presumed it was a joke for a lot of reasons.
Right.
Biggest one, he's one of the most reclusive members of any rock band
I've
ever heard of.
Had not previously been on Twitter, to your
knowledge.
He had
never been
on
Twitter. Yeah. I can't recall an interview he's done in 20 years or so.
Yeah, the last we heard from was when I was texting with him in 2006 or 7. Yeah. What year was that?
That was 2007.
Yeah, trying to get him to participate in Appetite. It's this weird thing where he would text back. He's perfectly friendly, but wouldn't do an interview.
Yeah.
And then then he thought I was Axl for a while and asked me a weird question, but that was another.
He thought you were Axl.
Yes.
Okay.
So
the fans are freaking out about this on the fan forum because they have a huge fan community.
Yeah, this is a public conversation.
Yeah, but I presumed it was some jokester because it's Twitter.
Totally unverified. You know,
unverified.
It was just a random new
account. Didn't have the blue check.
So I was all sarcastic back. I'm like, hi, Izzy. I can't imagine that there's any scenario that you're a fake Izzy because who lies on the internet? And he goes like, no, it's me. I want to talk to you. I just emailed you. I'm like, that's news to me. I don't see any email. And we're talking back and forth.
And he'd emailed what? Like the letters
at
Rolling Stone account?
He turns out he emailed rseditors@rollingstone.com.
Wow. Which is just the general account where
we get a billion
to everyone. If you're trying to reach someone, don't ever do that. That's not a good way to.
So this whole conversation is public, and there's like a 50-page thread on my GNR forum all about it. And every tweet I put is being obsessed over, and I'm just thinking it's a jokester. And then I go home that night, and he goes, I want to call you. So I said, okay. You know, now we're on DM. And I send him my phone number.
This is getting pretty steamy, actually.
Yeah. I send him my work phone number, which was a mistake. I should have him call my cell, I guess. And he goes, great, I just called you.
So I'm a guy with a voice box calling hello.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So I dialed into my office line, and there he was. And I'm like, that really sounds like him. Then I went on YouTube and found some interviews that he gave in the 90s. It was the same exact voice. And I'm like, holy shit, this is Izzy.
Should we play some of the clips?
Yeah, we should
let's play
some
of it.
Okay, and here it is.
Hey, Andy, it's Izzy calling. It's Tuesday, like 5:30, California time. It's me. I know there's a lot of questions, you know, regarding my Twitter account, but it's me. I opened a Twitter account. There was just so much speculation going on regarding my involvement and, you know, studio recording. There's so much just misinformation. So I wanted to clarify that I'm not in the studio with anybody recording any of the Guns N' Roses guys. At this point in time, I'm not involved in the actual shows. So anyway, I can't do an interview with you right now, but I wanted to get that information out just to let people know that a lot of the stuff they're reading is not true. And I think the Twitter account will be fun. And I might post some stuff on there this week, you know, throughout the week. Anyway, I hope you are. I just wanted to confirm it's me.
That was the second piece of fresh reporting from the only other members of the original Guns N' Roses in Rolling Stone.
Because Axl, Slash, and Duff have said not a word. Slash shared
the Coachella poster on Instagram with a smiley face. So the extent of Slash's public comments has been one little emoji.
And in context, I mean, this is not uncommon for bands embarking on a big tour or reunion. They don't want to mess things up.
Things are
fragile. There's a lot of contracts usually, are signed. They don't know how it's going to go.
But there's no precedent for this. But like with Van Halen, they had a press conference. With other groups, they put a picture out. They do some interviews. They'll have a press conference with Simon and Garfunkel or the Police. They have a huge press conference to get attention for the tour.
Well, the central question, right, is, or one of the central questions is, are Axl and Slash actually reconciled? Or is this kind of purely a business thing? Like, are they talking? Can they joke together? Can they interact? Or is it just like, you know, contractually, Slash may not look at Axl.
Well, I wonder.
That's a big question.
And
right?
I would suspect they're probably not great buddies. I mean, actually, you know, Courtney Barnett in the New Rolling Stone had a great kind of, she was asked about the Guns N' Roses reunion. She's a singer-songwriter, and she's a big Guns N' Roses fan. And she said, the thing about reunions is, it's like your divorced parents getting back together. It might be like a wish fulfillment thing for you. It might be fun for you, but it's probably not fun for them.
Yeah. You know? Well, and the weird reality, it's not going to sound that different. Slash is an awesome guitar player, but he brought in dudes that could play like him for the most part. You know?
It might sound more different than you think.
I hope so.
You know, the one thing I thought about is, you know, Izzy's motivations for reaching out to you. Now, he pointed fans to a couple of videos he recorded of cover songs. And if you look at the lyrics of the cover songs, they seem to imply a certain discontent with someone in your life who might be trying to control you or making decisions you're not happy about. So what I would bet is this wasn't Izzy being like, no one ever contacted me. I've never had anything to do with this. But rather, they made me an insulting offer.
Right.
They didn't involve me at the beginning, but they kind of half-heartedly tried to pull me in. I would bet that there was something that this he seems not thrilled with the situation.
Right.
And this is a little bit of projection. I can't be sure, but it seems like something went down that he's not. Or if they possibly they didn't ask him and he's mad about that. But there's some. Yeah. He's definitely not like a happy man about this situation.
Yeah, right. That's why interesting. Because I think if I'm Izzy, I'm going to think, I'm a co-founder of this band. I was there long before Slash. I was a key writer of most of the famous songs. I deserve as much as Slash.
Right.
And probably he's not going to offer that.
Right. On a marketing level, he doesn't. It's sort of like whatever his actual importance, on a marketing level, he doesn't have nearly the brand equity of Slash. And so if you are the guy deciding who gets what, you know, you might not, you know. And back in the day, they all split it. It's easy to forget. They once were like a band who all got
it. Did they actually split things equally back in the day, supposedly?
Before things went south, in the very beginning, then things started to go nuts. Right. But they were actually a band at one point.
Right. And this is actually not uncommon either, though, with reunions. It's like, because there are certain key people, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
Axl is the most key person, and then followed by Slash.
But also Axl now, the difference now is, and this is one of the things that happened as things went south, is Axl, of course, owns the name Guns N' Roses.
Right.
So now anyone else is his employee.
Yeah. Right.
So it's a very different situation.
Right. It's a different dynamic.
And what's amazing is Steven Adler has said nothing. This is a guy back in the day, I get on the phone in 5 minutes.
Steven Adler being the original
drummer.
Who's had a pretty fraught few decades. Yeah, he had a tough time. He was actually he was the guy thrown out of Guns N' Roses for doing too many drugs. You can imagine how many drugs that was. That's sort of the infamous. But because he's not complaining, everyone's best guess is that he's going to do that thing where they bring him out for 3 songs. You know, it's not like he can't play You Could Be Mine. He's not going to play anything from Use Your Illusion.
Right.
But he can still play the Appetite stuff. And so they'll bring him out. And they'll be like, ladies and gentlemen, special guest Steven Adler. People go nuts. Right. And then he goes off the stage and they pay him something. He's happy. Everyone's happy.
Well, that brings up the other questions. Yeah. Like some of the other unanswered questions. How are they going to handle like Chinese Democracy songs?
I bet they play them. I bet that.
You really?
I think they're going to. I think Axl's like, I want to play them. And it's like, it's his band. And
Slash
I think
will play better
I
and
think
just
they will
go
play
on
better.
With it.
Yeah. These are songs that Slash has never played on.
Yeah, Slash never played on.
I bet you they don't play them.
I admit that it's an issue of, you know, that is hard to predict, but I think that they'll play
them. I guess
them.
Duff has played them.
Duff has played them. Slash will just, he'll just play them. He can't, like, play all that weird Bumblefoot stuff, which I dig, but I mean.
And
but,
how does Bumblefoot fit into all this?
He's our.
Let me tell you something. Bumblefoot is a really good guitar player.
Yes.
And I'm told a really sweet guy. But
DJ Ashba's out and Bumblefoot's out.
Yes. This is the interesting thing. So there's a certain extent that this is really a hybrid of the new Guns N' Roses and the old Guns N' Roses. Roses, because the drummer is the guy who's been playing, as best as we can tell, is going to be Frank Ferrer, who is the new Guns N' Roses drummer. He's from the new lineup. So there's a certain extent to which it's a quote-unquote reunion and actually more of a
It's more of a composite.
Or it's the last lineup with special guest Slash.
Right. Just backing up for a minute, the big question, what do Guns N' Roses mean in 2016? How do they stack up?
They're the Led Zeppelin of the 80s in a lot of ways, or the Rolling Stones of the 80s or something, or the worst case scenario,
late 80s, but yes,
the Aerosmith of the late 80s. Well, it was like 86, whatever.
Well, that's not when they were born, by 88.
Okay,
I mean, I would say they're almost, they were the last, hard rock band before Nirvana, the last kind of classic, unironic, after Nirvana, you kind of couldn't be a hard rock band without it being a little... being a feeling like there's a little bit of a shtick or something, a little bit of retro. Guns N' Roses were like the last great traditional hard rock band.
I've written about this before, but it's like basically like Appetite for Destruction was sort of the last like classic rock
right.
album. It also was, by the way, recorded on tape, and edited, and so it was like kind of like the last before everything. I mean, everything's been sort of grandfathered in grunge too, but they do feel like the last part of that, the last gasp of that era. Look at how many Facebook fans they have. They remain phenomenally popular.
Yeah, and their T-shirts are all over town. Those songs are everywhere. Sweet Child of Mine is this sing-along classic now. Like, kids sing it in schools. It's just everywhere.
What?
I've seen children's choir sing it. I've seen YouTube clips of that. I'll show it to you later, bro.
I don't think a lot of younger people differentiate between them and Led Zeppelin in the sense of the classic rock continuum.
No, it's true.
People have ascended to that level, in hindsight.
And I think their brand name is actually kind of synonymous with just rock. It's like Guns N' Roses. So they have a lot to live up to, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, the funny thing would be they come out of Coachella and all the kids are over at the dance tent and they're being drowned out by
it's going to be a big deal. But the rollout's been weird that there's the two Vegas shows, there's the two Coachellas, and then there's Mexico, it's two stadiums, but they haven't rolled out a tour yet.
Well, what's going to happen next? All right, let's end with that. What do we think is going to happen after Coachella and the Vegas shows?
There's been no big stadium tour announced yet. It could mean they're waiting to Coachella for all the attendees. Or it could mean they can't agree on anything and they're having trouble figuring out a launch.
It works both ways. That basically, if Coachella goes well, then they have all these dates. I'm sure they have dates blocked out. So it's first of all, Coachella goes well, but they might as well announce it after Coachella to get the swell of attention. I wouldn't be surprised if the morning after Coachella all goes well, they announce a huge tour. That's probably the plan. But they probably reserve the right to pull the plug.
They don't want to get too greedy. If they try and play 50 stadiums and charge $350 a ticket, that's pushing it. And the question is, how damaged is the brand name? There's been so many GNR shows.
I don't think it matters. I think it's a big red reset button.
It must have hurt it a little bit.
10%, but it doesn't matter. I think most the nice
thing
is.
I think a lot of
people weren't even aware that these other tours were going on. A lot of people vaguely kind of thought maybe there was something going on, but now this will get all the attention and it'll just be big reset.
It's a light switches on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So there we go.
Well, there it is. Andy Green.
Yes.
Thank you for coming on.
No problem.
Brian Hyatt.
Thank you.
All right. We'll see.
All right.
And we're back with our reader mail segment. I'm here with contributing editor David Brown. What's up, David?
What's up, Nathan?
David just wrote a really nice piece about the late George Martin, the Beatles producer, who passed away this month. And predictably, we've already gotten a fair amount of reader mail. David, before we get into it, though, help people understand, what do you see as George Martin's importance? A lot of people don't realize. They see him as this dashing guy who is considerably older than the Beatles, kind of from another generation. He came from this era of Abbey Road where people still wore lab coats and ties.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you think he really did?
He let the Beatles become the Beatles, and that sounds like such a simple thing to say. But he's the first person who really in the music business saw their potential. You can remember they were rejected by a lot of record companies in England before EMI, and even other people at EMI weren't so thrilled with them. And he was the one who really first, when he saw them in the studio early on, saw that potential of their originals, of their harmonies. He made early suggestions to change tempos and to sing tighter harmonies. And then later on, he's the guy who didn't flinch when John would want a backwards vocal or distorted right. guitar. And, you know, producers back then wouldn't necessarily have been as open-minded as he was. And he was there like, was no let these guys do what they right. do, and I'll kind of guide it, and I'll make suggestions, and I'll sit in the control room and watch them work. But, you know, he had a very subtle but strong hand in helping them shape their music.
And there really wasn't a precedent for that at the time, right? I mean, it would have been so predictable and easy for him to be the older guy who just said, no, that's not how we do things.
Right. In fact, one of the people I interviewed for the story was Peter Asher, who was, of course, in Peter and Gordon, the British Invasion group, later worked for Apple Records. And he popped in once in a while to see the Beatles and George Martin at work, which was very rare. They didn't like any outsiders. But he would notice that, yes, like you just said, he put it exactly the same way. He said they would come up with some idea. John would say, I want my voice to sound like this or that. And anyone else would have said, no. And George would be like, no, that's fine. Let's try it. And, you know, Peter would also see George sometimes go out and just take a cup of tea, you know, and just leave them by themselves to kind of work things out and then come back in strategically and check in on them. To be fair,
the Beatles were a huge group by that time. So there yes. certainly was an incentive for George Martin to keep up. But he did keep up. I see he's like a kind of a perfect like producer in the sense that he actualized their wishes. Like he one example you cite in your piece is he really helped Paul McCartney cook up an orchestra for the famous Swoop in Day in the Life.
They had this idea, there's two different songs there, and they had this idea of like, well, how can we bridge them, put something in the middle to meld together John's first part and Paul's second part. And then Paul and John had this vague idea, let's get some orchestra, some string section, some real crazy symphonic thing. And they got the string section orchestra into the studio, and then it was George Martin's job to tell these classically trained musicians, no, you can't play in unison together, all playing the same notes at the same time. You all have to do crazy stuff individually and not listen to the next.
What do you mean?
Exactly. They're like, what are you talking about? And it was George Martin who had he studied oboe and piano. He was a musician. So he was able to translate that to those musicians, and we ended up with that great part. He's also the guy who really helped broaden their sound, like with Yesterday. He's the one who convinced Paul, like, let's just have you and a guitar and a little string section.
Oh, I believe in yesterday. Suddenly, I'm not half the man I used to be.
And Paul didn't want that. You know, they didn't make records like that. They made them as the Beatles. And that was step one in them experimenting more in the studio and trying stuff, not just as a four-piece rock and roll band. And that, of course, huge ramifications.
You also mentioned the little harpsichord or keyboard solo.
Yeah, the famous In My Life, like piano part that sounds like a harpsichord. He contributed little bits here and there.
All those little things he did are now just songs that are, these are songs that are embedded in our Western consciousness as these classics.
Absolutely.
And he was often the guy who helped make them happen.
Yeah, he didn't obviously write songs with them, but he enhanced their songbook. And he made those records really reverberate even more, I think. Yeah.
All right, well, let's get to some reader mail. Okay, this is from there's a comment on the site. This is from under the reader named Caveat Emptor. Who knows what would have become of the Beatles had they not wound up with George Martin as their producer? All right, well, this is a thought exercise.
That is an interesting question.
Maybe like the Dave Clark Five, maybe?
They could have been like just another one of those, you know, British invasion bands who were just stuck with that two guitar, bass, and drum stuff, but with better songs than some of those other than Jerry and the Pacemakers and whatnot.
Right.
Well, that's an interesting question.
Right. I mean, and it's like nothing to take away from Paul McCartney and John Lennon's genius, but, you know, a lot of things have to fall the right way for a band to get huge. And George Martin was definitely one of the things that fell the right way.
Absolutely. And Brian Epstein, their manager, I mean, they had a team around them of people who each advanced their music and sometimes their business in the best way.
You know? All right. Well, the next letter, this is from reader name, If It Makes You Happy. Unfortunately,
it can't
Martin,
be that sad.
unfortunately, Martin wasn't as selfless as legend would have it. According to the memoir of EMI engineer Jeff Emmerich, which is an excellent book, who came up with many of the innovations on Revolver, Pepper, and Abbey Road, certainly true, Emmerich, this is my own commentary, Emmerich was very important, whenever a photographer came to get behind-the-scenes shots of the Beatles at work, Martin would hustle Emmerich or any other technician out of the studio so he took center stage. Also gave no album credits. Guy apparently could not give credit where it was due. David, do you have an opinion on that?
You know, I spoke with Emmerich for the story, and he, you know, I think he's a little more respectful of George Martin now that he's passed away than when he wrote that book. But he basically, he would say that, you know, George wasn't, in his memory, Sir George, I guess we can call him now, was not in the studio hands-on as much as maybe legend has it. He would often be up in the control room. And what's interesting about the Abbey Road studios is that the control room where the producer and the crew engineer and the gear, that was upstairs. And so you look down upon the studio. And so George Martin would often be with the Emmerich and those guys up in that room looking down. And only occasionally.
He was like the Wizard of Oz kind of looking.
Exactly,
yeah, yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, I think there's perhaps some truth to the fact that, I mean, who knows, as far as, you know, getting credit. But, you know, you also have to remember this was a time when album credits on records were very, very rare. I mean, it really wasn't until, like, the early 70s, maybe, when you would see
people actually really wanted to
know who those musicians were and
except
all that.
For
you,
maybe
didn't,
jazz
you didn't
records.
Have that stuff on records. I mean, even on the Beatles, they don't credit Eric Clapton on While My Guitar Gently Weeps on the White Album.
Right.
I mean, unless it was added on a recent reissue, but, you know, that stuff was not considered important, I think.
It was a different time. We'll cut
them
the benefit of the doubt.
And now we're back to that time in the MP3 era when nobody knows what anybody does.
That's another episode. Okay. All right. Well, let's the final letter. This is from a reader named AntCon. why did the Beatles go with Phil Spector on Let It Be?
Well, that's a whole complicated story. George Martin actually did the recorded the original Let It Be sessions, which, if we remember, was just them in this very kind of huge warehouse kind of facility playing live and being filmed. And it was such a miserable experience that those tapes and that movie, which became Let It Be, were basically shelved for about a year. Like, it was nobody even wanted to go back to it. They just said, forget it. It's a failed project. We're going to make Abbey Road. So then what happens is, they decide a year or so later, well, let's do something. They have Alan Klein is now involved. He wants to get the product out there. Like, what about that movie and that album?
Right.
And so Klein and Spector were collaborators, were co-workers. Right. So Klein basically got Spector in to kind of sweeten up the tracks. He didn't like...
I think John Lennon liked the idea too, right? Was he one of the big...
Yes. Paul was furious. I've actually looked in the legal files in London of the Beatles lawsuits, and you see the letter from Paul that he wrote to Apple and to Phil Spector, because what happened was that Spector added all that stuff on Long and Winding Road, the choir and the strings.
Right.
He added it. Then they sent Paul a finished copy saying, here you go.
The Long and Winding Road
wrote this furious letter saying, "Do never do this again."
Yeah,
you know,
understandably.
This is my work.
I mean, it's pretty unprecedented
that would have happened to them.
And actually, I mean, as a coda, like, he hated that version so much, the version that most people know. He actually came out with that album, Let It Be Naked.
Yes.
Well, that Beatles, you know, that, which is kind of a remix of Let It Be, minus a lot of that syrupy Phil Spector
stuff.
That's
right. That was
about
Paul's
a decade
revenge.
Or so ago.
The long and winding road.
be honest, I like the strings and choir better.
Maybe well, I'm in by the minority. Now we just know that it's all we've known. So,
I know,
yeah,
exactly.
We're just used to them.
But I think it's beautiful, actually.
Right.
But,
right.
But, yeah, so that's the kind of long,
George Martin
story.
Wouldn't have let that happen.
Yeah.
So, that's for sure.
He might not, or he would have told Paul. I don't think George was averse to string sections, but
right.
I think he would have had them more involved.
He would have, yeah. He would have been a better mediator. Yeah. Let's talk one last minute about, like, what did George Martin go on to do after the Beatles? Like, what would you say were his finest works after the Beatles?
You know, his career after the Beatles in rock and roll, which was maybe 10 or 15 years or so, found him basically sort of riding the wave of 70s rock and what
right.
rock became after the Beatles. You know, he did
fusion
with the Mount Vishnu Orchestra and Jeff Beck. He did America, who was like a, you know, folk rock pop band. He did Cheap Trick. I mean, you know,
right.
he did Ultravox. He did a new wave record.
Well, you talked to Rick Nielsen or got
Rick
some
Nielsen,
quotes from Rick Nielsen for
Rick
your
Nielsen,
piece,
who
right?
said that did remember George just being a well-dressed guy in the studio. Still, in 1980, he was wearing collared shirts and all that. And he did bring something. Nielsen said that he felt that Martin would never look down on them. And that's another thing that Peter Asher told me about Martin working with the Beatles that made him really pivotal. Even though he had this classical background, even though he was not a rock and roller and he hated distorted guitars and things like that, he never had a snobby kind of air about him.
That,
it was
yeah.
very interesting. Maybe because he was a working class, he came from a working class family.
Well,
you
know, that's
he
an interesting
regal,
point. Right.
But, yeah, but he was he not looked, that.
Right,
you know?
Right. That's an interesting yeah. point. Like, do you remember what his parents did? I mean,
his
he came
mom
from.
His mom was a nurse and his dad was a carpenter.
Right.
Jeff Beck told me a funny story about, you know, how he thought that when he worked with George Martin in 1974 and 5 on those two great fusion albums of his, Blow by Blow and Wired. His first time he worked with George Martin, and he said his first person he ever met in rock who spoke Queen's English, and he joked once to his keyboard player, like, after the sessions, let's tail him in our car and see if he drives to Buckingham Palace. Because it was sort of a joke, but they
right.
actually, that's the one thing you heard over. I was like, he seemed like people would think, is he actually a member of the royal family?
But it was something he kind of grew into, right?
Yeah, he did. Yeah. He did. And
I mean,
it was really
interesting. I like what you touched on, though, about his openness. It seems like that was kind of the key things. And instead,
he
wasn't a hedgehog who kind of has all these ideas that
right.
he doesn't move off of. He was a fox, you know, and he kind of was able to adapt.
He was. And he was open to experimentation. And he didn't have that snobbery that so many people in the music business had about rock and roll in the 60s, and we forget that that was there. There
right.
was this sense of, well, that's not the real music. It's a fad. It'll
right.
come and go. We'll make some money.
Right.
But that's not, it's not jazz. It's not Sinatra, you know. And he didn't, you know, he might have had a little bit of that early on, it's possible, but that was all dispensed with within a few years, and Martin was definitely not, he was not condescending toward
right.
the musicians he worked with, which is another, you know, huge point in his favor.
But Oz never did give nothing to the Tin Man that he didn't already have.
Well, I talked to Jerry Beckley from America, Martin produced like half a dozen of their records and had some of his biggest hits with America, with Sister Golden Hair and Tin Man and Lonely People and that stuff. And he said once George Martin told him that Martin made more money off America records than Beatle records. Because back then in the 60s, producers didn't
right.
get a big share. That changed.
Right.
But I was
in the
60s,
especially from that era with Martin, you were just like a staffer who showed up.
Producer.
Right.
And it was only a few years in when Martin started his own production company and started making more money. But I was like, oh my God, I thought he made more money off of Tin Man
right.
than he did off of.
Where's the justice in that?
Exactly.
But hey, he did all right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Crazy, crazy business sometimes.
David Brown, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Nathan.
All right. And that's it for Rolling Stone Music Now. If you like what you heard, please leave a nice review on iTunes and maybe subscribe.